Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to Podnuts Daily, episode number 470, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I'm your host, Jeff Hallish. I'm joined today by Dave Greenbaum from Dr. Dave Computer Repair. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No problem. I'm excited to get you on. I know that we've been doing a lot of things together lately with the Toronto On Convention and different things, and I've gotten to know you a little bit better, and I'm glad you're finally coming on the show to share your story, your background about what you do in your business. But let's start off with basically, how did you get started in computer repair?
Well, I mean, this goes way, way, way back to the Apple II days.
Oh. And
yeah, I was in high school. Not a lot of the teachers knew computers and stuff like that. So I kind of ran the computer labs for the teachers and would fix things when they would occur. And we kind of moved on from there to doing that same stuff in college and doing that while I was in law school. And then I left law school to run a academic computer lab at a local university and then just jumped into the computer repair business. And that was about 1996.
Wow. Now you were going to law school. You were going to become a lawyer. And what made you decide to jump ship and go into the illustrious computer repair field?
Well, there were two things. Number one is they say from the old movie, The Paper Chase, look to the left of you, look to the right of you, one of you won't graduate. I looked to the left of me, I looked to the right of me, and I didn't like either person.
Okay.
So I decided, you know, I am too nice of a guy to be in this field, I thought. And I kind of hemmed and hawed about it. And really, the Kansas City Art Institute was looking for a computer lab technician. And I applied for the job. I thought I would just do it over the summer. And they offered me the directorship. I'm like, okay, I'm just barely out of college. And you're giving me this kind of position. And I was actually clerking for a judge at the time. And I asked his opinion. And a wise judge said, you know, you don't get an opportunity to come up like this every day. Why don't you try it? See if you like it. Law schools aren't going out of business. The field is not going to suddenly dry up. Make some money. If you decide later that you want to return to the law, you'll have made a year of income rather than paying for law school. And you can come back. And I never came back.
Okay. Oh, that's a great story. Oh, it's interesting what kind of leads us down our different paths.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. So you got started in computer repair. And right. Now how long ago was that you actually started your business?
I went full time in 2003.
Okay.
I was working for other companies and then I decided it was time to leave the business and steal all the previous clients of the other business. Not quite that way, but that's kind of how I think that's every technician's dream to do something like that. Been working for someone long enough. And it was really, for the most part, it was a 2-year plan. I had met with an attorney, found out the right way of doing it. So I didn't get my butt sued. That's the advantage of going to law school, as you know, a lot of attorneys. You fix their computers, they give you free legal advice.
Nice.
So I done that. And it wasn't really until my father, was very ill and I'd asked for some time off of work and my boss said, ain't gonna have it. I need you. I said, I don't think you understand. This is not an option. My father's on his deathbed. I'm going to take care of my family. And he said, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Wow.
So okay. I didn't. And that's really what was the impetus to starting my business. I'd been talking about it for so long. I need to go out on my own. A lot of my clients didn't like going through my boss. they wanted to talk directly to me. So, you know, at one point, they were paying for the cell phone for me. And then my boss said, you know, you're going to have to pay for your own cell phone. Money is tight. This was right after 9/11. The economy is drying up. And he said, you have to pay for your own cell phone. I said, but all these clients have this number. What am I going to do? He said, that's your problem. I said, well, can I send a letter out to them to tell them about my new cell phone? Because people won't be able to get hold of me. He's like, you can do it on your dime. I said, oh. The attorney said, yes, that's exactly the scenario you want. So I paid to send out a letter to all the clients they had done business with, telling them my new cell phone, which was actually a personal cell phone that I was paying for. So when I went out on my own, they already had the cell phone. They were contacting me directly.
Wow.
And all I was legally required to do was to say at the very end, and I wouldn't say it till the end, now I want to let you know I'm not working for my previous employer. If you're trying to reach them, here's their number. And it was only one client that, and I did this for about 2 years. I gave him this speech. It was only one client that asked for their number. And the reason was, is I was so booked, I couldn't see the person for a week. Wow. And she asked, do you think they're busy? I said, you know, I think they've had a change in staff. I don't think they're as busy anymore. So I think they'll be able to get you in sooner. And sure enough, she went with them. And then a few months later, she called me again and decided, no, I'd much rather deal with you.
Gotcha. So you already had a reputation built up with your previous employer as far as your customer base that you were servicing. And you were able to take that into your own business and basically take care of those customers the way that they liked to be helped.
Bingo. Okay. Usually, I think a lot of people enter this industry, they go out on their own, and they're first trying to ramp up and get that client base going. I had been doing this for three other companies up until I went out on my own. And those clients, it's kind of like I describe it like a doctor. You know, a doctor will join a different practice and stuff like that, and you'll follow the doctor to the next practice. So these customers were following me all the way along the line. So I had that great customer base. The first day I went out on my own, I was booked for over a week. Customers just lined up and I went ahead and serviced them.
Wow. Now, did you learn a lot from your previous employers as far as obviously, and I know a little bit about your business, you subcontract. Yeah. Did you learn a lot on how to deal with people that were working for you in your business?
I did. By the time that I was working for other people, I was kind of running the back office stuff. So I was doing the hiring, the accounting, pretty much everything but the actual computer repair. I could do a good job and I could pinch hit when someone called in sick or something like that. But towards the end, I was responsible for the back office stuff. So it was hiring, firing, training, everything. So in some ways I prefer that kind of back office stuff. You get me in front of QuickBooks and I am just very happy or in front of a spreadsheet.
Oh, you're such a geek.
I know. I mean, I can do the computer repair, but I actually kind of like the back office stuff. That's where I kind of really started doing things towards the end. You know, I started really in college, like most people, just kind of fixing things on the side. Then I started working for other companies and stuff like that. And then they eventually moved me to the back office operations.
Wow. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
So now, as far as did you learn some of the things not to do when you were dealing with people in your own business that maybe the way you were treated previous while you were working for other companies?
You know, I would say the thing that I learned was it's an industry term. We talk about firing a client, but you really need to do that sometimes. Sometimes a client just isn't a good fit. And when I was working for someone else, they were always about, I don't care. That's not my problem. I just want you to service the client, get the money, and deal with it. And it would cause me stress. It would cause stress on the client. It just wasn't a good fit. So there were a lot of times where I say, you know, either you're not a good fit for us or the type of service you're requesting isn't the type of service that we provide. So it's being very focused in the services you provide and telling people no. And most places that I'd worked for we can never say no to the client. And I feel very comfortable saying no, because when I had that instinct, this is not going to work out, we'd go out there, the client would be dissatisfied. I'd get yelled at for the client being dissatisfied, and we'd have to offer a refund. I'm like, what advantage to this? Why this relationship didn't work out? We should have just stopped it at the beginning.
Right. That's a great piece of advice right there that a lot of people, I think, even in their own businesses, don't follow today.
I would agree with that. I say no to customers all the time. I really do, because it's just not a good fit. You know, we're not getting along, or you're asking for service that we don't normally provide. You know, we focus on small office, home office, and residential. So while I know how to work on a server, and in an emergency, I could probably work on a server, I'd much rather refer that business to someone else, someone who works on servers day in and day out.
That's also a good point. I think a lot of times, and here's where we get ourselves in trouble, we become a jack of all trades and master of none.
Yeah.
And the point is, while we can do everything technology related, sometimes it's better to have the people that are going to do it, that, like you said, do it all the time. And I put it back to, there's certain things. I mean, I can hang drywall all day long, right? And it's not a big deal. Drywall is easy. You know, screw it in. No problem. Now, when it comes to mudding and taping that drywall, I will pay somebody to do it. Why? Because what takes me a week to do will take them literally hours, because they do it all the time.
And they probably do a better job. And they,
absolutely,
if something goes wrong, they know how to handle it. So when everything goes right, you can do a lot of things. But when something goes wrong, that's where you really need an expert with a ton of experience to fix those things when they go wrong.
Absolutely. Very good. Now, so what would you, what's most of your business? What would you say? Now, I know you said you do a little bit of everything there, small business, home business, and residential. Is it mostly residential?
It's about, I would say, 50% residential, as in the traditional home user. But then there's that 25 to 30% of someone who works out of their home, that's a telecommuter or is running a small business out of their home. Is that small office? Is that residential? It's a little bit unclear as far as walking into a business that's brick and mortar where people go to work each day. That's about 25%. And I limit it to 5 computers or less and no server. Because again, the server is outside my normal scope. And once you start getting to 5-6 computers, you need a server.
Right, right.
And they're going to have more problems on a daily basis. That's when you start getting into that magic word that I know you don't like, managed services.
No, let me clarify for a second.
I
don't mind managed services. What I don't like is what we tend to come up with terms to name ourselves something because it sounds glorious. And so somebody somewhere thought about, I'm a managed service provider, as they puff their chest out and I punch them in it. but the reality is, we run a business, we do manage services for our clients, whether it be small business, large business. And my whole point to the MSP thing is, MSP is, if you're a managed service provider, you are taking care of everything from front to back. In other words, sorry, Mr. and Mr. Customer, you cannot have those Dell computers because we only service HP and we only service this model and we only have this type of server. So here's all you can have if you want me to service you. That, in my opinion, is an actual managed service provider. A lot of us do a hybrid approach, which is we kind of deal with some of the stuff that they already have in place, and we figure out how to put our services on there to take care of them. So, not to beat a dead horse, but it's just a term that kind of irritates me, because sometimes we tend to make stuff up. In my opinion, this is one of those times where we've come up with a term that sounds really, really good and it makes us look really, really smart. But then again,
I'm an expert on the cloud.
Yes.
That's another one of those terms. Yeah.
So anyways, I'm sorry to sidetrack you there.
So no, it's so far. I really think once you start getting into those big numbers, that's when you need ongoing maintenance and a little bit of the proactive stuff. So I will do, I'll work on a client that has much more computers, but almost always that's a client that has a bunch of computers and has a few Macs. So I'll go in, I will work on the Macs, and there will be another provider, whether it's a managed service provider or hybrid break fix that works on the PCs.
Okay. Very cool. Now, I think the way that we do things sometimes is, and I just lost my train of thought.
That's okay.
I hate when that happens.
No, it's okay. So we were talking about, you know, the residential stuff, that's my yes. primary focus, and I don't really deal with businesses. Because the other reason I don't necessarily like the businesses is they have big emergencies.
Sure.
You have to drop what you're doing because people's jobs are dependent upon getting that computer fixed. And while residential clients will tell you it's absolutely the end of the world that their computer's not working, in reality, it's not that case. It can wait till tomorrow or something like that. I get Junior can't do his homework, Mom can't pay her bills, and Dad can't remote into the office. I get that, but that's not the same as a business that can't service their clients. The only type of businesses I like that are food-related businesses, because when you go down, I will drop what I'm doing if I like what you're serving and provide you service, but you better provide me lunch or dinner.
That's good.
It's true. It's true. Evenings, weekends, they know they can get to me.
I remember what I was going to say. So 80% of businesses are small businesses that basically run and are the backbone of this country. And yeah. I think you're hitting a market that needs to be hit. And again, the bigger MSPs, if you will, yeah. they don't want to deal with those 5 computers and under, sometimes even 10 computers and under. They want to 20, 25, 50 computers. And to me, those aren't what I would consider small business. Small business is these little mom and pop shops that might sell insurance or whatever. And that's how they run their business. And those are good. Or a hair salon or whatever. You know, there's lots of small businesses out there that I think could be well taken care of that don't necessarily need a server, but they use things like databases. They use software that to pay their bills. They use different things to, you know, audit their accounts or whatever, take payments, all these types of things that need to be dealt with. And that's where I think a lot of us can actually excel at if we become good in those areas.
I agree completely. Probably if I had to classify the small business clients, probably the number one client I have, and again, I don't know if you'd consider them small office, home office, residential, is real estate agents.
Yes.
If they can't get their computer working, they have been working 3 months on a deal, and that deal goes away if they can't get their email and can't get online and can't print their contracts. Now, they work out of, they're independent contractors type, so they're working out of an office, but they're also working at wherever the site is that they're selling. So
right.
they have to, you know, they are allowed to use whoever they want for computer support. A lot of therapists, either massage therapists or mental health therapists, are a good chunk of my client base because they just have one computer. They need to file insurance. They need to do print out forms for their clients and stuff like that. So they don't need a server. They don't need an IT support company. They just need someone when occasionally they have a problem, they know who to call to get it taken care of. And that's kind of the service they provide is when you're need a massage, when you're in pain or another chiropractic offices too, you have a problem, you go there, you get fixed and you may not see them for 3 or 4 years. And that's okay. Well, I can go on average about 3 years between seeing clients and I am fine with that.
Gotcha. That's good. I'm just thinking about the doctor's office or the dentist's office or a lot of these different places or massage therapists. I mean, when in different businesses do things differently, but when can you call up and say, hey, I've got an emergency. I'm going to be there like in an hour and you're going to fix me. They're like, no, sir, you need to make an appointment. And yeah. guess what?
Yeah.
As human beings, even when we're in pain, we're okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always the ER, but in the ER, you're going to wait 3 or 4 hours.
Exactly.
All their goal is to stabilize you until you can see a primary care professional.
Right. Exactly. So a lot of times I look at this industry and I go, why do we run around like chickens with our heads cut off in trying to deal with these things when a customer says, oh, this is an emergency? Because I look at it from a standpoint of, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of things that I would consider an emergency, but it doesn't get taken care of any faster. Now, granted, there are certain businesses, very few and far between, in my opinion, that actually could not operate without their computers. There are those. But I would say most of them are not that way. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree. You know, I have a client. It's a funny story with this client. One time went into the hospital, into the ER, kind of had a rash. We weren't sure what it was. And the guy's trying to talk to me and to try to get my mind off of things. We talk computers and we talk, you know, Mac and stuff like that. 3 years later, the guy calls me with a computer problem. And he's like, I remember you from the ER and I remembered your name and wrote it down. So if I ever had a Mac problem, I know who to call. And we have a great relationship now. And I remember one time there was an emergency and I was stressed out and he heard me. He's like, you know, I work in the ER and we learn how to triage things. We will listen to our patients, but we are the ones that determine whether something is an emergency or not, because the patient doesn't have the skill to know that. We can tell through an interview the difference between a heart attack and heartburn. Mm. And we have a responsibility to our patients to make sure that the person that has a heart attack is treated faster than the person with heartburn. Right. So I kind of kept that in mind of really listening to the client, but recognizing what is an emergency and what is not, and triaging it properly. And that's our job as the technician, consultant, therapist, to make sure that we don't let our clients determine our schedule, that we determine the schedule, because we're the professionals that know what we're doing. They're the panicked customer. And I get that there's panic and you need to be, you know, calm down and comforting and stuff like that. But ultimately, I need to decide whether it's a true emergency or not. Computer on fire, that's a true emergency, but don't call me, call the fire department. Right. First. I actually had a customer do that one time. There's smoke coming out of my computer. I said, unplug it right now. Are you sure I won't lose my data? Unplug it right now if you see smoke coming out.
Wow.
The power supply, I think, kind of got overheated. The fan wasn't working and something didn't kick in. And apparently there was smoke coming out, because I looked at it afterwards and it was melty inside.
Oh. Now, Dave,
and that smell is wonderful after something like that happens.
Now, Dave, you said you work on Macs. Now, there are a lot of shops out there that will not work on Macs for various reasons. How have you found that? How far does your support go? Do you do both hardware and software, or is it mostly maintaining of software on those machines?
I mean, we do most of the software stuff. The hardware, it's rough because Apple pretty much controls the supply chain on that.
Okay.
So it's really hard to get non-industry standard parts. So hard drives, very easy to replace. When we're talking screens or even cables inside, it's very difficult. And we generally don't do it because any part we're going to get is gray market, third party, or counterfeit. And I feel like if I give a client a part like that, then I can't really stand behind it. So that's when we'll refer them to the Apple store, or we'll really talk about, you know, a screen repair. You know, this is a 5-year-old computer. Other problems will start develop. Are you sure it's not time to replace it? And customers just need to be educated. They think, I spent $1,500 on this computer 5 years ago. So what is it worth, $1,000 now?
Right. No.
No, it's not. So we'll go on, a lot of times we'll go on eBay or something like that. I'll say, you know, this computer is worth $300. So even if we could repair the screen for $200, your net return is $100 on this. Wouldn't it make more sense to put this towards the new computer? And that's when we start talking, well, I'm concerned about my data. Not a problem. We can transfer the data.
Right.
So we'll do a lot of that. hard drives, very, very common. You know, same thing, PC, Macs, they use the same style hard drives for the most part. So they're going to go out every 3 to 5 years on average. Batteries. Batteries are very easy to replace on a Mac. Got a great supplier for that. I'm a firm believer in other role computing. Good quality parts. Go ahead and replace the battery on that. And RAM. You know, Apple, just like Windows, has been pushing those free. We've been dealing in the Mac world for free operating system updates for many years now. So someone will do an operating system upgrade, their computer will slow down, and they'll want more RAM. And that's something we can do.
Okay. So there are certain things that you'll deal with. Yeah, I've found the same thing when it comes to trying to find those parts, even if you can find the used or gray market parts or whatever. No. It's they're just, I mean, I do the same things with regular PC laptops. I get a lot of times you can only get used parts, and I explain to the customer, most of these parts have a 30-day warranty. And depending on how much it's going to cost to replace, is this something you really want to do? Or, like you said, is it time to go ahead and get that upgrade? And it really, yeah, shelf life on any computer really is no more than 5 years. And quite honestly, I'd really like to see three. But that's just
and that's
my
what
personal
I tell
opinion.
Customers.
Right.
The analogy I use is 3 years on a computer is like 100,000 miles on a car. Mm. Now that's not saying you always get rid of it at 100,000.
Right.
But that's kind of that magic mark when you start having problems, and each year adds 100,000 to the car or to the computer. So if you take good care of it and stuff like that, and you just drive it to and from the grocery store, it might last a little bit longer. I tell customers, well, think about it this way. Your car has 200,000 miles on it. Your only daughter is driving cross country to college in it. Do you trust that car with her for 4 years as opposed to her going to the local community college and driving back and forth to class each day? You're more likely in that limited capacity to say, well, okay, we can use this older car. That's fine. But it becomes less trustworthy. And that's where we get into the professionals like the therapists or the real estate agents is, are you prepared when you press that button one day that you won't see anything on your screen and you won't know what patients you're seeing or what deals are going to close that day? And they usually say, yep, you're absolutely right. It's time for a new computer. I want a computer that's reliable.
That's
good. And we don't sell computers. And I tell, we don't sell computers. I say, I know this sounds crazy. I'm talking myself out of work, but it's in your best interest. And I'm in it for the long haul to create that trust relationship. And sometimes they'll go down the street and get it repaired somewhere else. And that's fine. You know, that company did nothing ethically wrong telling someone to take a 5-year-old laptop and replace the screen for $200. I don't feel that that's in the best interest of the customer, and I'm not going to recommend that option.
Gotcha.
And I don't necessarily want customers who are not going to take my advice. I think this is what's in your best interest. You know, go see someone else. I say to them, you know, if everyone took doctor's advice, Benson and Hedges and McDonald's would be out of business.
I don't know who Benson and Hedges is, but I know who McDonald's is.
Oh, well, you know, it's cigarettes.
Oh, smoking. Gotcha. Okay.
If everyone stopped smoking and eating fast food, you know, that's, and gotcha. Put on their seatbelts.
Oh, yes. Yes. True. True. Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah. It's hard because when it comes to screen repairs, usually if it's right around 5 years or less, actually, probably not even that, probably 4 years or less, I say, yeah, we'll go ahead and do a screen replacement. But what I did notice on the Mac side is when I would look up a screen, once they went to the Retina display, oh my, those things are really expensive. You know, I can get a laptop screen on a general 15.6 inch, pretty much any resolution for $50. Maybe a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on the model or whatever. And so that's fairly inexpensive. I'm looking at these Retina displays and I'm like anywhere between $200 and $300 just for the display. I'm like, oh. So yeah. And it's hard to balance that because obviously the people that are getting screens replaced on laptops have spent a little bit less than what they've spent on a Mac. So I don't. Now, when somebody asks you the question, PC or Mac, what do you tell them?
if they ask me, I'll ask them what they do with it. Now, I usually won't get that question for the most part, because people who like their PCs want to stay with the PCs. It's usually when they've got an iPhone or an iPad, they're like, you know, I kind of like this. Should I go with a Mac? And say, you're going to pay twice as much for the Mac. You just are when you compare stats and stuff like that. But you're paying for that convenience and that integration between devices and stuff like that. So I say, I personally use a Mac. I like a Mac, but I also use a PC because there's certain tools. I run QuickBooks on my PC. QuickBooks on the Mac is horrible.
Okay.
QuickBooks on the PC is so much better. So I say, hey, I work on both. I'll tell you this, I'm going to see you less on a Mac. We just, they're 50% of our client base, but they're only 25% of our billable hours. We just don't see the Mac customers that much.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it's really with the customer. It depends on the software they use. So if someone said, I'm primarily using QuickBooks, I would say avoid the Mac. But if you're talking Microsoft Office stuff, when it comes to pictures, you know, Apple's picture management software with iPhoto and now Photos is awesome. It just makes things so easy. And if you already have the iPhone and the iPad, they just start all talking to each other and they're one big happy family.
You know, it's funny you say that, Dave, because I just moved a customer off of her Mac because the photos were so ridiculous to find, and she couldn't figure out, and I couldn't figure it out either, where everything was coming from. She has an iPhone that was downloading these photos, and I actually had to move 35,000 photos from iCloud down to her brand new PC so that we could put Carbonite on it to back it up, because it's one thing. I don't mind the hierarchy of all these things that do communicate together, but I kind of miss the old days where I can go, I know 100% if I go in my pictures folder, absolutely every picture, whether downloaded from the internet or put on there by me through camera or whatever, is in that singular folder, versus I've got iCloud, I've got iPhoto, I've got this. It's all these things that are like, I don't know that they communicate that well, or maybe it's just that when you have that many pictures, it's very hard to keep track of. And I don't deal in Macs too much, so I don't really know. I just know it was confusing for her, and she preferred when she had a PC years ago, so we moved her over to a brand new PC.
And that's what it comes down to, is what the customer feels comfortable with. It's like a car. Everyone's going to have an opinion about what the best car is out there, but ultimately it's what you feel comfortable driving. If you don't feel comfortable driving it and you don't get it, then it's not a good fit for you, no matter what any Consumer Reports or any other third-party service says is best. If you don't like the car, if you don't feel comfortable with it, then you shouldn't be driving it.
Now, you know, it's funny because there was something that had come up a while back, and you probably remember this, but they were saying that Apple was no longer supporting QuickTime, the app for Windows PCs, because everything's integrated into iTunes now and all that. So they said they were no longer supporting it. It was full of holes, and they let everybody know. And it's funny because I'm still today, when I get a machine in, it's one of the things that I have to remove, because it was installed back when iTunes, whatever, was put on a computer originally. And it was just there. So it's like, and the end consumer doesn't really know. So I found that interesting that's still around. And to be honest with you, what's funny is for playing snippets, especially for the shows that I do, I was actually using QuickTime because it worked so much better than even Windows Media Player.
Yeah. Apple just kind of realized it was too hard to maintain. And I'm sure we're going to get to that point with Adobe Flash very soon, I hope. They're going to be like, there are so many holes in this thing. We're sick and tired of patching it. Please don't use our product anymore.
Yeah, good luck with that. Here's the problem. The problem is not the technology itself. If we could go away and put everybody and force everybody to HTML5, that would be fine. But if you've seen some of the deprecated websites that are out there, they're horrible. And these people are not going to spend any money. I look at websites all the time and I go, and I know they're making good money doing whatever it is they're doing. And I'm like, who set this piece of garbage up for you? This is so old. It looks like we're stuck in the 90s.
But stop talking about my website, Jeff.
Well, you know, I wasn't going to say anything about yours, but it looks great on Edge.
But it looks great on Netscape 1.0. I had a customer that was running a really old. I'm like, hey, it works. Yay.
But I think that's the biggest problem is nobody wants to spend money when it comes to websites and IT support as far as maintaining their websites and stuff like that. So they get the cheapest person in town a lot of times to do it. And that's why nobody's going to force everybody to code over to HTML5. So therefore, you're going to be left with, Flash. The other thing people ask all the time, there's really only two products when I'm doing an install or setting up a computer for the first time that I put on most people's computers. And I've heard that a lot of people don't actually do this, but Java being one of them, because I don't know if you know about Pogo games or things like that. Well, guess what? You need Java to run them. They ain't going anywhere. And those are going to be around for, and that company is making $1 billion off the $10 a month or whatever per subscriber that they're getting. And they're still not, they're like, yeah, no, Java works. And the other thing too is what I found is big corporations, Ford, GM, Chrysler, put any 2 to 3 letter, 4 letter word in there. And all these companies, if I want to check my pay stub online for Ford Motor Company, yeah, guess what I got to have? Oh, I got to have Java installed. Or guess what? I can't see my pay stub.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
So this is the problem we're running into. Nobody wants to move the needle forward in order to make this happen. And that's why I love the resolve of people going, we're going to get rid of this, and I can't wait till it goes. And I'm going, it's not going to be in your lifetime, but okay. Keep fighting that fight. That again, just my opinion. And it's just what I see out there. And it is frustrating. You wish you could flip a switch and just move everybody over to the next greatest thing. But here's the other thing too. I think a lot of times what we don't realize is the next biggest thing is also going to be the thing that people concentrate on and attack. So guess what? Now everybody moves from, oh, my eyes are off of Flash, but I'm going to move into HTML5 or whatever other different venues are being used in a browser, and I'm going to figure out how to circumvent those. Because you can build a better mousetrap, but the mouse just gets smarter.
Totally. No, the thing that we've dealt with, that happened on Friday with the DNS attacks, it was Internet of Things devices. We're getting all these cameras and stuff like that in our homes, and we're not updating the firmware, changing the passwords, and it's being used to take down the internet.
That's the next big thing. Yeah, I'm very cautious on which IoT devices. And as a matter of fact, I only have two. One is the Amazon Echo, and the other is the Ring doorbell. Those are the only two devices I have. And I probably should separate them off. I've got them on the other half of my network, so they are separated in a fashion, the other half that I don't use. But those are the only two that I know of so far that are fairly, not being attacked, or when they have found problems, they've actually fixed those problems with firmware and are actually keeping up with it.
Yeah, and you have to make sure that you do update. The Echo, I'm not as familiar with the Ring. I don't know if it does this stuff automatically.
Yes.
But a lot of these devices, like a router, you have to manually go in and do the firmware. And you manually have to go in. The customer installs it. Oh, hey, everything's working great. It's got the default password, the default firmware. And it's the cheap cameras they found on Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
That will do that type of stuff.
Baby monitors. So,
it's the next big thing. Yes.
I just look at this stuff and I go, listen, I understand everybody wanting to move ahead with technology, but I look at it, a baby monitor. I look at when my kids were born and the monitors we had. It was basically a two-way radio. Yes, there was a radio signal going through, and yes, you could probably scan it and get that information if you wanted to, if you were close enough, so on and so forth. But the reality is, it was a simple system that basically talked back and forth over a period of 20 to 30 feet, whatever it was. And that's all you really needed. Now you got all these things. Hey, let me connect this to the internet.
Well, and that's part of our job is when, you know, since I do mostly on-site stuff, if I see that in someone's home, I will say, hey, do you mind if we spend a few minutes and update the firmware on that? Do you mind if we change the password and stuff like that to make sure that they are not susceptible to that? And I say on a regular basis, we should, if you're not checking this, then we should be checking this.
Nice.
And it's a good upsell.
Yeah. No, and it's good. And you're doing what you're supposed to do. You're taking care of that customer. You're looking out for their best interests.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's primarily our job in the industry is to look out for stuff like that. They rely on us as their technology experts. And sometimes they don't know to ask the right questions. They don't, you know, we'll discuss backups with every customer.
So, oh.
And they having to explain a backup sometimes is, you know, the example, yeah, I've got a backup. I've got an external hard drive. Okay. So that's a duplicate of your data. Now it's just backed up. Okay. So sometimes I'll literally take a piece of paper and we have a two-part form. I'll rip it in half. And I'll say, okay, now this is a backup. If I destroy this, now this is an original. Oh, I was just moving stuff off the computer onto that external and I was deleting stuff.
Right.
Oh, now I get it. So they don't know to have that discussion about backups. And again, coming from the, you know, a little bit of listening to some of the medical industry, you go to the ER for anything. It's interesting. They will mark on the end of the form, be sure to wear your seatbelts. They will discuss it with every patient because they have a responsibility. They don't want to see these people. That's one of the key things you can do to keep safe. So we will have a discussion with every single client about backups.
Wow.
Do you have a backup? Okay. You have a backup. Show me. Let's run a test. And if everything checks out and they've got the backup, it's working, it's been tested recently, then I'll say, so tell me about that time you lost the data. Because the only people who do backups to this level have lost data at some point.
Yes.
And it's a great conversation piece. Otherwise, they don't always get it. And they rely on us to teach them that before they learn on their own the hard way.
Now, Dave, what do you consider to be a proper backup?
Ideally, there's a local backup and an on-site backup.
Okay.
Offsite,
right. I knew what you meant.
Yeah. Cloud backup, I'm a firm believer in. I have a preference for Backblaze. They have a great partner program. They're very responsive. I prefer that over Carbonite. It's great on the Mac. That's one of the other reasons I like it. And then some kind of hard drive scenario, either a synchronization type scenario. You know, obviously on the Mac, we have Time Machine, and that's really easy. If they're on the PC, we'll usually use the Windows backup because that's, you know, for the most part, they don't want to spend a lot of money and that's good enough if they're doing the offsite backup.
Okay.
Yeah, because when there's an emergency, if there's a large restore, it's easier to do with the local backup. But if it's a onesie twosie, I deleted a file or something like that, it's usually easier to do it with the I believe the offsite backup, because then it's a training opportunity and show them how to do it. I had a client one time who had a situation like that. She deleted a file and she didn't realize it until she left town. And I said, you know, if you go to Backblaze's website, you can download that file at your new location. And she's like, oh my God, that's the most incredible thing.
Right.
she was just amazed by that. I'm like, yeah, that's the beauty of a cloud-based backup. That data is available to you anywhere. Because, you know, living in Kansas, we're in tornado country. So we've had a couple tornadoes here in town over the years, and homes are destroyed and you want to have something off-site. If there's an objection, I would rather a client do an off-site backup than a local backup. In some ways an easier sell because a hard drive is going to be $50 to $100 depending upon how much they need to back up, where I can say, hey, Backblaze is $50 a year. Let's do this first year. Let's see how it goes. And then it kind of renews itself and they ask, should we renew? I'd say it's peace of mind. I kind of like that.
Because right.
Trying to get them to do both is just really, really hard. It's like insurance. It's, you know, people get the minimums until something happens. And then they're like, I want to be insured against that.
See, so. I had to make a good informed decision for myself, and I will not sell. So I sell carbonite, resell it.
Yeah.
And I will not sell just the offsite backup. In matter of fact, I require them, if you want me to set you up with carbonite, you're going to buy this $59 external hard drive, Western Digital, that we're going to plug in your computer. And you're going to buy not the $50 a year plan. You're going to buy the $100 a year plan because you're going to have both. Because here's the thing. I never felt comfortable with just having somebody that had only an offsite or only a local.
Yeah.
And so to me, you got to have all three trees, right? You got to have what's the original. You got to have the local image. And then you've got to have the offsite backup where they can grab files from and get it wherever. So it's the best of all three worlds all at the same time. And so I had to make that decision for myself because I just never felt comfortable. And I know there's a lot of people out there that were actually, and you're not doing this, but there was a lot of people that were just pushing the cloud backup. And they said, oh, if you've got the cloud, you're good until something happens. Even though a lot of these bigger companies will back up on different servers all over the basically all over the United States or all over the world, wherever they're located. And so the chances of you losing that data are probably not very good. But I've also heard the horror stories of people that go, something happens to their computer, they go to pull their data, and it's like, oh my gosh, something happened. It was never backed up. And they didn't have that local image to go back in there and go, whew, you know, this thing is happening every day and it's right here on my computer. So that's just a decision I had to make for myself.
I would love it if people did both of those. I find take the slow but steady approach. The other thing that we do, which is helpful, is I used to do this all via mail, but now I kind of have a mix between email and postcards. Twice a year, they get a reminder when the clocks change, you're supposed to check your fire alarms. So we have a fall back and spring ahead special where we'll come out and we'll test your backups for half our normal price. Now, nice. With existing clients, I'm doing this more via email and doing remote sessions, but I have a prospect list that from other places, businesses I've bought out and stuff like that. So they'll get a physical postcard. And okay. When they say, hey, you know, we'll go out there and the backup doesn't work, I'll say, well, you know, we had that backup special. We were going to test it. Oh, I didn't want to pay the $40 to test my backups. Well, now it's going to go to Drive Savers and it's going to be $5,000. So, you know, penny wise, pound foolish. And I started that program where I had a client who we were using CrashPlan and we did exact same way. We had an external backup and we had the online. So they should have been protected. Well, they had a storm, which blew everything out. So it blew out the computer. It blew out the external hard drive. I'm like, okay, we've got the offsite backup. This should work great. Found out about 6 months before that the owner allowed their kid to play some kind of game and the backup was running. So he just uninstalled the backup software. He was going to install it again. They were furious at me. And I said, this isn't my fault. Your kid uninstalled this. And of course, children can do no wrong, stuff like that. I don't know. You should have had it more protected and stuff like that. So the good news was because it was such a large claim, because so much was damaged, we were able to send it off to Drive Savers and it was completely covered by insurance. So they were out no money with that. But that's when I started this program of reminding clients. So it's a sales opportunity. And it's also a cover your butt opportunity because I can say you got the postcard, you got the email. Well, yeah, but I didn't want to spend the money. So, okay, they have to be tested twice a year because lots of things can happen. What happens that I find is, number one, the credit card expired. And they've been getting these emails to update the credit card or else your account will be deleted. And they never check their spam filter. They reuse the password and it was compromised. So some hacker went in and changed it. Or what's also common is they changed email addresses and they don't remember the old email address. And we don't remember the password. So how are we going to get into that account?
That's interesting. And that's the other, and I've heard both sides of the story where some people will say, they won't do a reselling program per se because they don't want the responsibility. What they'll do is they will point the customer in the right direction, have them sign up or sign them up using their credit card, so on and so forth. And I also wrestled with that. And I said, okay, I could do that, except then that I'm getting no notification for if the backups are happening. So one of the things that I do is I actually only do it on my managed service, which gives you antivirus updates, cleaning temp files, all that kind of stuff with a MSP style service. And
I just threw up a little bit. Yeah.
So that's one of the things that I will put in there is you can have just the antivirus and all this stuff, or you can have that plus a backup. But on my contracts, I have two checkboxes. We are doing your backup or we are not doing your backup, and you're using Carbonite or whatever, you're using your own or you're using mine. So that was the best way that I could think of, because when a backup's not happening and I know about it, then at least I can inform the customer and go, hey, backup's not happening. Just wanted to let you know. And that can be a simple email send off to them. It doesn't take a whole lot of time to do that. And, you know, kind of protects me from, if they ignore it or don't do anything about it, or I don't hear from them, you know, I guess I could escalate it and give them a phone call. Usually people respond and go, yeah, I know I was on vacation, or haven't turned the computer on in 4 weeks, whatever. Yeah. And I do get that with certain customers because they don't turn it on all the time.
So. Yeah. It's something. And going to the unconvention and talking with other people, that's something I'm definitely considering. And I've even spoken with Backblaze about it, because like I said, you have to pick your horse, and that's the one I picked.
Right.
And that's a concern that I don't get those notifications and they don't have local backups. So Hopefully they'll integrate that at some point. My concern is always if I have 20 of those going off at once, I've got to make those phone calls or send off those emails, and I'm not doing the other aspects of the business. But it is important that we kind of manage that a little bit better. So that's definitely something I need to consider.
Yeah, and it's a rough scenario because it's the same reason that there's other people that will not recommend an antivirus, a paid-for antivirus. Because if you recommend anything, you sell it to them. For some reason, we feel like we're on the hook when it's like, well, wait a minute, they could have went down to the store and bought that same thing right off the shelf. Why are we feeling obligated? Well, we were the one that gave them the advice, right? So
it's true.
It's a catch-22, and it's a rough scenario. So I've picked my battles and said, you're either going to do my managed services or I'm not selling you antivirus. You get whatever's on the computer, and that's it, and we'll go from there. But anyways, so
makes sense.
Dave, let's go into, now I know you do many other things, and you said you like the back office stuff, so this makes a lot of sense. You also have written for different blogs out there. You want to go into that and basically how you got started in that and why the desire to write?
Sure. You know, I originally started this goes way back to the days of David Pogue when he was first starting. I sent him an email my senior year of college, and I said, I've read about you. You write books. You're a consultant to the stars. I want to be like you. And he sent me an email back. He says, you need to get involved in user groups. You need to start writing for Macintosh user groups, their newsletters, and doing software reviews. And eventually you'll get well known. People respect and trust you. And that will lead to paid gigs, both for writing and for computer service. And that's exactly what I did. I got involved in a user group and started writing for them and started writing reviews. And then, someone from the user group said, hey, we've got some paid gigs. Do you want to do this? So I did my first paid gig. It was for MacNN. And then the Apple blog had a call for writer. So I applied there, started writing there. Then they became GigaOM, and I wrote for them for a number of years. And then Lifehacker went ahead and did a call for writer. So I did that for about a year. And around that same time, Bryce from TechNibble was looking for writers. So honestly, of all the places I write for, I love TechNibble the best because I'm talking directly to my audience and sharing my wisdom and helping the industry. You know, the mistakes that I made and the lessons that I learned early on, I can explain those to people and make them better technicians overall.
Oh, that's awesome. And that's great to be able to share that stuff. And that's really, it's the same reason we do the podcast, because I won't say a horrible writer, but I can't write. But I can talk. So apparently you can do either or, which is good. It's nice that you're ambidextrous that way, but
yeah, I really enjoy sharing that. And even sometimes writing an article makes me think a lot about my processes, and then people will comment on it. I'm like, you know, that's something I didn't think of, because we all have something to learn. That was like one of those things from the Unconvention. I had kind of gone in, well, gosh, I've been doing this on my own for almost 14 years. How much am I really going to learn? And right. I learned so much from other technicians, because you get so focused on the way you're doing things. You meet someone explains it to you, you're like, that aha moment. Yeah, I really should be doing that. I see your point of view. It makes a lot of sense. And when you get such a diverse audience, from someone who's just starting out to someone who's been doing it 10 or 15 years, moves from the break fix, the retail, the hybrid model, the MSP, all that stuff, you learn things along the way.
Yes, absolutely. And what I love about this business, and a lot of people, I've heard people that are saying, well, I want to transition from this to this. And what I say to that is, there's a lot of different ways of doing business. In all of them, done right, can be profitable, and you can actually make a living on if you choose to. I don't think we have to follow a certain path. I think we can follow the niches that we are good at.
It makes total sense. If we take something from that medical industry, is you don't say, I'm a general practitioner, but gosh darn it, I just wasn't good enough to be a cardiologist or something like that. Yeah, maybe the cardiologist may make more money, and that might be a good business model, but there's a lot that goes on with that. There's something to be said for what makes you happy and what makes you enjoy life. If you dread going to work every day and dread seeing those customers, then you need to change your business model. Because when it comes down to it, if you're not happy and you're not enjoying life, you're doing something wrong.
Absolutely. I agree.
And I love the break fix, the residential, getting to chat with clients, kind of taking that laid back approach. I'm not there all day. You know, when I first started my business, one of the clients I stole, and we'll put that in heavy quotations because my lawyers told me I didn't steal them. They chose me.
Right.
was a major business that they had 50 computers. I would go there 3 times a week, 8 hours a day. Sit in a cubicle and fixing computers. I made a ton of money. And it was great. And that helped handle some of the other aspects of the starting out of the business, of buying equipment, you know, buying t-shirts, buying business cards and stuff like that. But then one day, my contact changed and they said, yeah, you know, we're going to bring all this in-house. So overnight, my business dropped by 20%. And that hurt. So I vowed never to be in that position, but I was so bored. I would just dread going there each day, sitting in a cubicle, just reimaging machines and people bringing their problems to me. And I never got to really interact with the clients.
Right.
And really chat with them. Now with the residential stuff, I'm not sitting at a desk all day. I'm driving around. I'm meeting people. I'm chatting with them. I'm getting to know my community. I love it.
That's
people
awesome.
Bake me cookies, stuff like that. Again, the restaurants, you know, beer, coffee, you've got me. Anytime, call me at 2 a.m. and I will be at your location. That's not a problem.
Nice. Very cool. Well, let's talk about real quick, because I don't think we mentioned this, but you said you're mostly on site. Now, I understand that you have an office that's outside of your home.
Right.
You want to explain that a little?
Sure. I actually have sort of two. I have a co-working space, which is downtown Kansas City. So that's a 45-minute drive from my location. And what's nice about that is that's right near the Apple store. So when people look for Apple repairs, I'm going to come up on the top on Google when they don't want to take it to the Apple store, because Apple like has policies. If it's more than 5 years old or so, they consider it either vintage or obsolete, and they won't work on it regardless of the situation.
Right.
They just don't want to be responsible for it because they want to sell you a new computer. So I've got what I call a consulting office. I'm in the same building with accountants, and you know, we have a massage therapist and a chiropractor downstairs, and we've got some mental health professionals upstairs. And it's not a drop-in type place. It's in an office building, so I'm not going to get any foot traffic. So it's that place where someone doesn't want an on-site, or I think it's going to be too difficult for on-site, we'll go ahead and we'll meet with them at that office. Or when, because I've got some other technicians I work with, it's too complex to do it on-site. You know, for example, we go there, we're like, oh, it's a bad hard drive. Okay, so now we got to bring it back to the office. We've got to put in a hard drive, and we've got to install an operating system and run the updates. So that's much better done in an office environment. Okay. So it works out. It works out really well. People will Google us, and they will come to the door and be surprised that there's no one there. But there's a clear sign that says by appointment only, and we try to do as a selling point. It's like, instead of letting your computer sit on a shelf for 2 weeks, we'll meet with you right then and there. When you have that appointment, that time is reserved exclusively for you, and we'll get it fixed. So people say, well, how long does it take to get a computer fixed? And I'll say, well, we will fix it when we have that appointment, for the most part, right then and there. It's not going to wait around. What's the point of you dropping it off at a shop, letting it sit for a week, wondering whether the computer's fixed, wondering what's going on? Or for the most part, you bring it to me, we're going to get it done right then and there, and you're going to have it back the same day. And people love that.
Nice. Yeah, that's very good. Because I went from, in my business, I went from a 24-hour turnaround to, yeah, you'll probably get it back in 48 to 72 hours. And that's the clientele that I went for. Now, a lot of people, they love those quick turnarounds, and there is definitely an audience for that. For me, it was like, yeah, I understand your computer is important. I want to make sure it's done right, and I'm going to take the time with it, because especially I do it part-time, and I don't have those solid hours that I can sit there and just bang away on those computers. So I'll get it done in a good amount of time. And sometimes it can be 24 hours, but I don't ever promise that. I say 24 to 48 to 72 hours is a general turnaround time, or I'll say 24 to 48 hours if I find nothing weird wrong.
Yeah.
And most customers are like, okay, that's fine. You know, that's not a big deal. And the funny thing is, they'll actually drive to me. I don't even have to drive to them, which is beautiful. But, you know, again, just a different type of clientele.
And yeah, we started doing that. We started offering, you know, it's a $10, depending on where you are, usually it's a $10 trip charge to go on site.
Okay.
And so we sometimes get a little bit price conscious customers, and they're like, well, it's a laptop. Why should I have to pay $10 for you to come out here? Can I just bring it to you? And when you're starting out, it's your home. You don't necessarily want people in your home. You have to worry about liability issues if they walk up to the door and they slip and fall, stuff like that. So that's really where the office came out. And then we were just like, no, we don't do a trip charge if you bring it to us.
Oh, nice.
So that worked out. That worked out really well. And, you know, I've experimented. I'm going to start experimenting with, you got to meet your clients where they are. And a lot of people were coming by and saying, hey, I found you on Google. You've got great reviews, but you're closed. So we're going to start experimenting with Friday walk-ins.
Oh, nice.
I don't know how it'll go. I have a technician that apparently just brought on board. He's got an expensive car. He says, it's really, I don't want to be driving it everywhere. It's a gas guzzler. It's one of these big cars. And he's like, I just want to work in the office. I said, okay, well, let's experiment. Let's start having, you know, Friday walk-ins, see how it goes. And that's where we'll start doing the things like scheduling those backup checkups, and stuff like that. Bring it in on Fridays, no appointment necessary. And when these customers say, hey, I don't have time to make an appointment, I've got such a busy schedule, can I just drop it off to you? Totally, we can do that on Friday. So we're going to start that starting November. Nice. And I'll see how it goes.
And that's nice about this business, is you can experiment with your own business and figure out exactly what's going to work for you. And that's the great thing about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Totally. Yeah, so it works out. It works out pretty well. It works out when I have, because I have two other technicians working with me, I don't want them coming into my home either. I don't want the risk of having these computers here. And if I'm not home, how are they going to pick it up? So once I started bringing someone else on board, I realized I needed a location outside of my home where we could coordinate things. So in some ways, it's just a depot for people to drop stuff off and to keep inventory. Because what's the point if I have a hard drive when another customer needs it? We need a central location.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Well, yeah. Dave, I appreciate all the information that you've brought to the show. It's a ton of great information, and I've learned a lot. Learned a lot about you, about your business, and how you're running things. And I really appreciate the things that you're doing. If people wanted to find out more about you, where could they get a hold of you?
Well, probably the easiest thing to do is to Google computer repair Lawrence, Kansas. And I should come up first. And if I don't, still click on me, so I'll eventually come up first. or if you want to go to my website directly, it's calldrdave.com. That's CallDrDave.com. And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. On Twitter, my handle's the same, calldrdave.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. All right. If you guys want to find me on the Google Plus, you can find me at Jeffrey Hallish or Twitter at TechNutPC. And if you'd like to be a guest on the show like Dave was, email me guest@podnuts.com. I want to thank our sponsor, Instant House Call, for this episode of Podnuts Daily. Don't forget, if you need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for the TechNimble Computer Business Kit over at podnuts.com. You too can help support the Podnuts Network. The next time you're shopping on Amazon, go to podnuts.com/Amazon. I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts Daily. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.